Hey everybody, welcome to the Washington University Emergency Medicine Journal Club Article of the Month podcast, June 2013. This month I'm going to talk about an article that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, June 20th. This is called Rapid Blood Pressure Lowering in Patients with Acute Intracerebral Hemorrhage. For a little context, patients coming in with hemorrhagic stroke or intracerebral hemorrhage frequently present to the ER with significantly elevated blood pressures that require urgent treatment. The problem is the correct goal blood pressure is still debatable. On the one hand, there's the concern that the hydrostatic effects of an elevated blood pressure can contribute to expansion of the hematoma, increased edema and rebleeding, and therefore make the patient sicker. On the other hand, overcorrection of the blood pressure can lead to decreased cerebral perfusion in the setting of autoregulation. Current American Heart Association, American Stroke Association recommendations for the management of blood pressure in spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage are as follows. If the systolic blood pressure is over 200 millimeters of mercury or the MAPs greater than 150, then consider aggressive reduction of blood pressure with continuous IV medication. If the systolic pressure is over 180 or the MAPs over 130 and there's the possibility of elevated intracranial pressure, then consider intracranial pressure monitoring and reducing the blood pressure using intermittent or continuous IV medications while maintaining a cerebral perfusion pressure over 60. Now, if the systolic is greater than 180 or the MAP is greater than 130 and there's no evidence of elevated intracranial pressure, then consider a modest reduction of blood pressure, e.g., a MAP of 110 or a target blood pressure of 160 over 90, using intermittent or continuous IV medications to control blood pressure. Finally, they have the caveat that in patients presenting with systolic blood pressure of 150 to 220, acute lowering of systolic blood pressure to 140 is probably safe. Now, that last statement is based on the INTERACT pilot study. For those wondering, INTERACT stands for Intensive Blood Pressure Reduction in Acute Cerebral Hemorrhage Trial. That looked at 440 patients comparing a goal systolic blood pressure of 140 with more modest reductions to 180 millimeters of mercury. They found a trend towards reduced hematoma growth with no increase in neurologic deterioration or differences in other clinical outcomes such as disability or quality of life in patients treated with more aggressive blood pressure lowering. The study, however, was underpowered to detect significant differences in any of the outcomes. But again, that was the INTERACT pilot study. So what the authors did was conduct a follow-up study. That brings us to INTERACT 2, which is the study that we're talking about today, the rapid blood pressure lowering in patients with acute intracerebral hemorrhage. So this was an international multicenter prospective randomized trial. The study was open treatment by necessity, meaning that patients and providers were not blinded to group allocation. They couldn't be due to the nature of the study. They were blinded, however, to the endpoint of the trial, and outcome assessors were blinded to group allocation. Patients were excluded if they had a definite contraindication to blood pressure lowering treatment, if treatment could not be initiated within 6 hours of intracerebral hemorrhage, if there was a structural cause for the intracerebral hemorrhage, or if they had a GCS of 3 to 5, i.e. deep coma. They were also excluded if they had a massive hematoma with poor prognosis, or if early surgical evacuation of the hematoma was planned. So in other words, these aren't the really, really sick patients that we're pretty sure aren't going to survive, or the ones who need to go emergently to the OR. These are the relatively more stable patients. So the patients were randomized to two groups. In group one, the intensive treatment group, IV and oral antihypertensive treatment was initiated by protocols based on local availability of agents with the goal of achieving a systolic blood pressure less than 140 millimeters of mercury within 1 hour of randomization and maintaining this level for 7 days. In the standard treatment group, blood pressure lowering treatment was initiated if the systolic blood pressure was over 180 with no lower level stipulated. All patients were started on oral antihypertensives within 7 days or at the time of hospital discharge, and patients were followed up either in person or by telephone at 28 days and 90 days by local staff blinded to treatment group allocation. Patients were analyzed by the intention to treat principle. So if you got randomized to one of the groups but didn't get treated appropriately in that group, you were still analyzed within that group. The a priori defined primary outcome was the proportion of patients with a poor outcome. This was defined as either death or severe disability with a score of 3 to 5 on the modified Rankin scale at 90 days after randomization. Initially, the key secondary outcome was death or severe disability in patients in whom treatment was initiated within 4 hours of onset of intracerebral hemorrhage. After the data was collected, but prior to data analysis, the authors decided to change their key secondary outcome to physical function across all 7 levels of the modified Rankin scale using ordinal analysis. Other secondary outcomes included all-cause mortality, cause-specific mortality, health-related quality of life, duration of hospitalization, residents at a residential care facility at 90 days, poor outcomes at 7 and 28 days, and serious adverse events, including neurologic deterioration or severe hypotension. They also looked at change in hematoma size in a subset of patients who underwent repeat CT or MRI at 24 hours post-intracerebral hemorrhage. Between October 2008 and August 2012, 2,839 patients were enrolled in 144 hospitals in 21 different countries. 1,403 were assigned to the intensive treatment group, and 1,436 were assigned to the standard treatment group. Patients were similar with respect to known prognostic factors, with the exception of warfarin use. 3.6% of patients in the intensive treatment group were on warfarin versus 2.2% in the standard treatment group for a p-value of 0.025. Approximately 68% of all patients recruited were from Chinese hospitals. And in terms of treatment, patients in the intensive treatment group received antihypertensive more quickly and had more rapid lowering of blood pressure than those in the standard treatment group, which is to be expected. Of note, patients in the intensive treatment group were more likely to have care withdrawn than those in the standard treatment group, 5.4% versus 3.3% for a p-value of 0.005. Primary outcome was assessed in 98.5% of intensive treatment patients and 98.3% of standard treatment patients, so excellent follow-up in this study. So on to the results. For the primary outcome, the proportion of patients with a poor outcome at 90 days, there was no difference between the intensive treatment group and the standard treatment group, 52% versus 55.6%, with an odds ratio of 0.87, 95% confidence interval, was 0.75 to 1.01, so it just barely crosses 1. Ordinal analysis showed a favorable shift in the distribution of scores on the modified Rankin scale for patients in the intensive treatment group. Pooled odds ratio for a shift to a higher score was 0.87, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.77 to 1.00. The rate of death from any cause was similar for the two groups, 11.9% versus 12%, as was the percentage of deaths directly attributed to intracerebral hemorrhage, the duration of hospitalization, and rates of serious adverse events. Patients in the intensive treatment group reported better quality of life at 90 days using the European Quality of Life 5-Dimension Questionnaire, which assesses mobility, self-care, usual activities, pain or discomfort, and anxiety or depression, each of which is graded on a 3-level scale as either no problems, moderate problems, or extreme problems. Compared to the standard treatment group, the mean utility score was 0.6 versus 0.55, with a p-value of 0.002. A subset of patients underwent repeat brain imaging at 24 hours. 35.1% of the intensive treatment group and 33.1% of the standard treatment group had repeat imaging performed. Now, there was no difference in the mean hematoma growth between the two groups. The relative difference was 4.5% with a 95% confidence interval for minus 3.1% to 12.7% and an absolute difference of 1.4 milliliters with a 95% confidence interval of minus 0.6 milliliters to 3.4 milliliters. All right, so how do we interpret all this? Well, the authors note that while intensive lowering of blood pressure in intracerebral hemorrhage did not result in a significant reduction in the primary outcome, there were better functional outcomes when an ordinal analysis of the primary outcome was undertaken. The ordinal analysis showed a very slight benefit with intensive lowering of blood pressure with a 95% confidence interval that just reaches 1.00. The p-value was 0.04. Keep in mind that the authors chose to perform the ordinal analysis after the data had been collected. One should always be wary when investigators change the study in some way after data collection has been initiated. In this case, the author's reasoning was that ordinal analysis began gaining acceptance in clinical trials partway through the course of this trial, which is pretty reasonable. Also, keep in mind that this is the secondary outcome, not the primary outcome, which was selected a priori. For the other secondary outcome of quality of life, using this EQ5D utility score, the scores were slightly different, 0.6 versus 0.55. The clinical significance of this difference is unfortunately difficult to interpret. If my overall score is 0.6, how much better off am I than someone with a score of 0.55? Issues of external validity have been raised for this study as well. Primary concern is that the majority of the patients in the study were recruited from Chinese institutions, 68% from China. We have to ask two questions. One is, are Chinese patients with intracerebral hemorrhage somehow different than patients in our own institutions? And two, is the treatment of intracerebral hemorrhage at Chinese hospitals different than treatment here in the U.S.? Now, given that the majority of patients with spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage are treated with supportive care, and that the indications for invasive procedures such as ICP monitoring, craniotomy, craniectomy are likely the same at any large hospital with neurosurgical capability, I suspect that the results likely would be valid in the U.S. Additional studies at U.S. institutions may help elucidate this a little bit further. One additional concern was that there was no specified antihypertensive agent or protocol to be followed, but rather it depended on local drug availability. It seems plausible that more rapid lowering of blood pressure using a continuous infusion of a titratable agent such as nicardipine would result in better outcomes than, say, intermittent boluses of labetalol. So I think this is a valid concern, and again, one that should be addressed in further studies. All right, so bottom line, well, the authors conclude that early intensive lowering of blood pressure in this patient population is safe, which is in keeping with the AHA-ASA guidelines, and I tend to agree. The primary concern with lowering blood pressure in these patients was decreased cerebral perfusion pressure, leading to neurologic deterioration. This study looked at neurologic deterioration in the first 24 hours and found no differences between the two groups. This study alone should by no means make intensive lowering of blood pressure an intracranial hemorrhage standard of care, as there's not a clear benefit, but it does seem to show that it's at least safe and points to the need for further investigation. It would be nice to see a large study conducted here in the United States using a strict protocol for the lowering of blood pressure and using an a priori ordinal analysis of neurologic outcomes. All right, so what about this whole ordinal analysis business? What is this? Well, the authors in this study used an ordinal analysis of the modified Rankin score. The Rankin score is an example of a type of categorical data known as ordinal data, in which numerical scores are arbitrarily assigned to levels of measurement. The assigned number itself has no meaning other than to provide a scale for reference. Examples include the pain scores, where 0 out of 10 means no pain, 10 out of 10 is severe pain, and 12 out of 10 means you're an asshole. Classically, studies that look at outcomes based on ordinal data have applied a cutoff, thus turning a scale with multiple levels into a dichotomous outcome. Instead of worrying about whether you're a 1, 2, or 3, we only care about whether you're above or below the cutoff. We can then compare the proportions above or below that cutoff in two groups and assign p-values or chi-square values. Ordinal analysis, on the other hand, uses more complex statistical calculations to look at how outcomes shift across the entire spectrum of the scale. Now, I'm not going to pretend to understand these calculations, but ordinal analysis has been shown to have higher statistical power to detect differences in outcomes between two groups than using binary outcomes alone. Let's take a quick hypothetical example to explain this a little bit better. Let's say we're doing a study involving 20 patients, 10 randomly assigned to the treatment group, 10 randomly assigned to the control group. The outcome I'm looking at is scores on the modified Rankin scale. I'm going to dichotomize and say that a score of 0 through 3 is a good outcome, and a score of 4 through 6 is a bad outcome. In this study, 5 patients in each group ended up with a score of 0 through 3, i.e. a good outcome, and 5 patients ended up with a score of 4 through 6, i.e. a bad outcome, for a risk of 50% in each group and a relative risk of 1. When I look at it that way, it looks like the treatment doesn't have any effect on the outcomes. But if we look at this more closely, the 5 patients in the treatment group who ended up with a good outcome had a score of 0, meaning no symptoms, whereas the 5 patients in the control group with a good outcome had scores of 3, meaning moderate disability, requiring some help but able to walk unassisted. The 5 patients in the treatment group who had a bad outcome had scores of 4, moderately severe disability, unable to attend to own bodily needs without assistance, and unable to walk unassisted, whereas the 5 patients in the control group who had a bad outcome had scores of 6, meaning they were dead. So when we dichotomize this outcome, it looks like the treatment and control groups had the same outcomes. However, I think we would all agree that the treatment group had much better outcomes than the control group. Using an ordinal analysis, we'd be able to detect these differences, and even more subtle differences, and hence conclude that the treatment group did better than the control group. We started to see this used a lot in stroke data, such as in the IST3 trial and in data on traumatic brain injuries. All right, guys, so that's it for the June 2013 Article of the Month podcast. Glad you could join me. And don't forget to check us out online at emjclub.com, follow us on Twitter at emjclub, and like us on Facebook, also at emjclub. Hope to see you guys back next time.